ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Thursday, the 12th of March. I'm Melissa Clark in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. To the Middle East conflict, Iran has threatened to attack vessels in the Strait of Hormuz, and overnight, UK authorities said three cargo ships had been struck by projectiles. Oil and gas supply through the key shipping lane has been severely constrained by the risk of attack, causing global supply shortages and soaring prices. It's led to dozens of countries agreeing to release a record amount of oil from their emergency reserves. All 32 of the International Energy Agency's members, including Australia, voted in support of the action, which gives countries the option of releasing their reserves over the next 90 days. The Australian government is now considering whether to do that. The International Energy Agency's Executive Director, Fatih Birol, says the group is responding to unprecedented challenges.
IEA countries have unanimously decided to launch the largest ever release of emergency oil stocks in our agency's history. IEA countries will be making 400 million barrels of oil available. But to be clear, the most important thing for a return to stable flows of oil and gas is the resumption of transit through the Strait of Hormuz.
The IEA's Fatih Birol there. Most shipping companies are unwilling to take the risk of transiting through the Strait of Hormuz right now, but the US president is encouraging tankers to make the journey, saying the US has neutralised the threat. Correspondent Barbara Miller is in Washington. Barb, what did we hear from the president on the Strait of Hormuz?
Well, a day ago, we heard that he was very concerned about possible mines in the key shipping lane. He threatened Iran and said that they should remove any mines they had laid. Now he says that the US has effectively taken out almost all of these mine-laying boats. And he says that it is now safe for ships to cross the Strait of Hormuz. That seems at odds with a couple of things. Firstly, there have been some unknown projectiles striking a number of cargo vessels there. And we also had this message today from US Central Command. They put out advice to civilians living close to port facilities along the strait. And they said that the regime was using them to conduct military operations that threaten international shipping. That would seem to suggest there is still a pretty active threat there. But let's just have a listen to part of the exchange on this issue. This is Donald Trump about to board Marine One, the presidential chopper. So a lot of background noise, but let's have a listen.
You talked to the CEOs of various oil companies, encouraging them to use the Strait of Hormuz.
Yeah, I think they should. I think they should use the Strait.
How do you respond?
Look, we took out just about all of their mine ships in one night.
Donald Trump there. And Barb, the New York Times has some reporting into the investigation into the strike on a school in Iran. What can you tell us there?
Yeah, what the New York Times says is that the preliminary investigation has found that the target coordinates were false for that strike and that the U.S. was responsible for hitting a strike. It says that the U.S. was working on outdated data. Now, Donald Trump was asked earlier about those findings. He brushed off that question. He said he didn't know about that. The White House has said he will accept the results of the investigation, but they've been trying to, I guess, block the question essentially up until now, saying the investigation's still ongoing. I think there's a limit to how long they can keep not answering questions on this. And if we haven't reached it today with this New York Times reporting, I think we're pretty close to it.
Barbara Miller in Washington. In Australia, there's been petrol price spikes and a jump in demand for fuel. The federal government is warning suppliers they'll face double penalties for misleading conduct or cartel behaviour. Fuel companies are being called to an urgent meeting with the Competition and Consumer Watchdog to discuss petrol prices since the outbreak of the war. The ACCC is moving to weekly price monitoring and will work with the sector to coordinate supply and unlock bottlenecks. It comes as experts warn Australia remains ill-prepared, as Annie Guest reports.
as authorities insist panic buying and stockpiling are causing fuel issues rather than an overall supply shortage, former Treasury Secretary Ken Henry agrees, but says Australia is unprepared regardless.
This is a wake-up call. We are, ironically, confronting right now a stalling of the rollout of renewable energy that is desperately needed in order to reduce the reliance upon fossil fuels. We should be accelerating this rollout. It should not be stalled.
Ken Henry, who's the chairman of the Australian Climate and Biodiversity Foundation, says the lack of progress on some major renewables projects is because some people are concerned about land clearing for wind or solar farms.
It's just absolutely crazy that our climate policy is being seen to be in competition with protection of the environment. After all, the whole point of climate policy is to secure a more livable planet.
Changes to the Environmental Protection and Biodiversity Act, legislated in November, aimed to address these concerns through detailed mapping called bioregional plans. It shows which areas can be developed and which need to be conserved. Ken Henry says this year's budget must provide funding for the changes.
And we're calling for $40 to $50 million over 4 years to be invested in the development of bioregional plans. We're also calling for Environment Information Australia to be funded. We think probably $45 million will be required to deliver the critical data that will be needed to underpin the development of those bioregional plans.
AM approached the Minister for the Environment, Murray Watt, for a response. A government spokesperson says the Commonwealth states and territories continue to work together on the reforms, including through pilot programs. The Institute for Integrated Economic Research Australia also wants renewables expedited. But its chairman, John Blackburn, who's also the former deputy chief of the Air Force, says the first step is a national energy security assessment.
If you don't understand your risks and you don't understand your vulnerabilities and you haven't made a strategy and plan, then what you do is you react to the next crisis. We've got to prepare for a range of crises, not just continue to react. We reacted to the pandemic because we didn't prepare. We're reacting to this because we haven't adequately prepared. We're too complacent.
John Blackburn also asserts that Australia is complacent about certain international obligations.
As a member of the International Energy Agency countries, member agency, we're supposed to have what's called 90 days of net imports. It doesn't really reflect specific fuel you can use in Australia, but it's a measure. What do you import? What do you export? What does it mean? How many days capacity do you have in the country? We are the only member country, all member countries, that doesn't meet our 90-day requirement. It's currently 50 days.
The Minister for Energy, Chris Bowen, says the purpose of the International Energy Agency's 90-day requirement is for selling overseas if necessary and is unrelated to domestic supply.
Our minimum stock obligation, which this government put in place to be held in Australia for Australians at times of crisis, is in place. Nationally, our stocks are good. We are working cooperatively with the industry to ensure that it is delivered to the regions that are experiencing shortages as quickly and as efficiently as possible.
Energy Minister Chris Bowen there, ending Annie Guest's report. The death toll in Lebanon is now more than 600 after a week of Israeli strikes against claimed Hezbollah targets. More than 700,000 Lebanese residents are now registered as displaced. The humanitarian crisis is putting immense strain on the financially crippled country, with people forced to camp in tents and charities picking up the slack. Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran reports.
In the plaza around Lebanon's largest stadium, children are being entertained by volunteers, trying to keep their mind off what's happening around them. Kamil Shemun Sports City is on the edge of Hezbollah's Beirut stronghold suburb of Dahia. 45,000 people can fill its stands for football matches, but there are now more than 800 people living in tents underneath.
Well, unfortunately, this is a crisis that involves all of Lebanon.
Beirut's mayor is Ibrahim Zaidan.
These people have escaped very dangerous situations
And they have seek shelter in the city. We started with 20 locations. Now we've reached 100 locations that we have filled with people that need aid, support, and place to sleep in.
The stadium is hosting just a fraction of the hundreds of thousands of people displaced across the country. Among them is Yasmin, who left her home with her husband and children when Israel started issuing warnings.
We were bathing the children when they immediately issued a warning to evacuate the entire southern suburbs of Beirut. So we quickly put our things in a van and left right away. The van was rented, but then they took the van from us and we ended up in the street.
Israeli strikes across Beirut and beyond are continuing as the IDF attacks claimed Hezbollah targets after the militant group entered the broader conflict last week and launched rockets and drones at Israel. An apartment block outside of Dahiya, the latest target. But as civilians flee their homes, charities are being forced to step in and provide basic services.
We cannot tell no for anyone.
Mariam's Kitchen is one of those organizations. Its founder is Father Hani Tolk.
Normally in our kitchen, Mariam Kitchen, we distribute, we provide 3,000 hot meals every day. But with this war and with the place, we are obliged to go with 5,000 hot meals every day. And it's not easy.
One of the women helping in the kitchen is Iman Jafal, a yoga teacher displaced from the city of Tyre further south. The memories of previous attacks still raw. Iman said it took her family more than 12 hours to drive less than 100 kilometres to Beirut because of clogged roads.
Honestly, even the last time we were afraid, but this time it feels worse. That's my feeling, but I don't want to think that way. Hopefully my feeling is wrong.
A sentiment shared across the community. This is Matthew Doran in Jerusalem, reporting for AM.
The promotion of Conservative Queensland Senator Matt Canavan to leader of the National Party settles the team leading the coalition after months of internal disputes in both the Nationals and the Liberals. The outspoken backbencher will now work alongside fellow Conservative Angus Taylor as the coalition tries to rebuild from last year's election loss. Former Conservative politicians say the challenges ahead are enormous, but the strategy could pay off. Political reporter Samantha Dick has the story.
Retired National Senator John Williams says no matter what people think about Matt Canavan, the rebel backbencher turned National Party leader knows how to cut through to voters.
What can Matt Canavan do? He can sell a message, Samantha, and I think he's going to be very good at that.
After months of infighting within the coalition, the Nationals have a new-look leadership team after the resignation of David Littleproud, with Queensland Senator Matt Canavan elected as leader and Victorian MP Darren Chester as his deputy.
He's a good man, he's got good policies, he's got a good brain, he's an economist.
With Conservative Liberal leader Angus Taylor working in tandem with Matt Canavan, it appears the coalition believes the answer to last year's withering election defeat lies in shifting further to the right. Former moderate Liberal MP Keith Wallahan, who lost the seat of Menzies in Melbourne's northeastern suburbs, says the road to recovery has barely started.
I don't think we're even a base camp off the mountain that we have to climb.
He says the coalition faces the twin challenge of chasing back votes in inner city seats at risk by Teal independents and defending votes in regional areas under threat by Pauline Hanson's One Nation Party.
57% of the parliament is metropolitan. But I think at the moment there is a real political threat in the regions that many Nationals and rural and regional Liberals may lose their seats to One Nation.
Despite Matt Canavan's vocal support for building new coal-fired power stations and his strong opposition to a net zero emissions target by 2050, Keith Wallahan says he doesn't think the Senator's key leadership role will deter inner-city voters who want stronger action on climate change.
I think Matt's capable of recognising that and recognising there are legitimate concerns about the environment and climate change.
Jill Shepherd is an associate professor in politics at the Australian National University. She says the Nationals have taken a risk by electing a divisive backbencher to the leadership, but it could pay dividends.
If this, you know, punt pays off and Matt Canavan can take a populist approach to rural voters, leaving Angus Taylor to speak freely to inner suburban voters, then I think it's well worth a try and it may well work.
Once a staffer to former Nationals MP Barnaby Joyce, who defected to One Nation last year, Matt Canavan recently spoke out against Pauline Hanson over her latest derogatory comments about Muslim Australians. Keith Wallahan says it's this kind of behaviour that sets Matt Canavan apart from others in Australia's right wing.
And so that shows a strength of character in him as a person.
With 2 years until the next federal election, former National Senator John Williams says the pressure is on to unite the coalition and get on with the job.
Let's face it, if you have a weak opposition, you're going to have a weak government.
Former National Senator John Williams, ending that report by Samantha Dick. Now, you might not think a pinball machine has a place in Australian cultural history, but five made in Newcastle more than 40 years ago have just been added to the National Film and Sound Archive. They feature classic Australiana designs and will soon be open to members of the public to test out their skills. Gianfranco Di Giovanni prepared this report.
It's a world of flashing lights, deafening noise and constant money flow. And Lord knows where the money comes from.
In 1979, the ABC's Four Corners took a closer look at pinball parlours and asked if the latest gaming craze was harming Australian teens.
There's a certain addiction. Like, we have a pinball parlour near the school and I know the guy. I might get some money off him, you know. Some people, they fever.
This kid, his mother gave him the rent to go and pay, and he went and spent it on pinballs. I spend about $2 a day in the mornings when I go to school and then just miss out on my lunch.
These days, the pinball machine is remembered less as a moral panic and more as a popular pastime. Its cultural significance is being recognised by the National Film and Sound Archive, which has just snapped up five Australian-made machines. They were developed in the late 70s and 80s by Newcastle brothers David and Peter Hankin. David Hankin explains the machines available were expensive to import.
We went into full-scale production of pinball machines. We had no idea what we were starting. You know, had no idea how complicated it was. And we were very lucky in that Newcastle University produced some pretty smart young guys, and we were able to look at American pinball machines, how they worked and what they did, and then design our own electronics. And that was the big deal. It took us months and months to produce the electronics for a pinball machine.
Every component was made here, including the boards. Chris Arneal says it led to some unique looks for a local audience. He's a digital games curator at the National Film and Sound Archive.
Because Hankin was making these machines with no intention for overseas distribution. So they could really harness like Australiana in the designs. We look after Australia's audiovisual heritage. And yeah, when you see pinball machines that are just so Australian, it's really exciting.
One of the designs featured the Australian car model, the FJ Holden. Another is dedicated to West Australian fast bowler Dennis Lilly. And there's the world's first Star Wars pinball machine. David Hankin still can't believe the company secured a deal with the creator, George Lucas, who only wanted one machine in return.
We approached him and said, would he be interested in doing something like this, or allowing us to do something like this? And the answer, surprisingly, was yes, happy to do it. And, you know, we were flabbergasted. And here we are, this pint-sized pinball manufacturer.
The complicated designs of the machines made them prone to failure, but it was the introduction of the arcade game Space Invaders in 1980 that sent them to the tip. Canberra-based collectors Stephen and Cassandra Smith have been tracking down the elusive Hankin machines.
We think that there's probably less than 150 across all five of the titles still available. He only made 1,150 across all five. And that was between 1978 and 1980, so that they're extremely rare and extremely popular.
Is it fun to play?
They're great fun to play.
The National Film and Sound Archive will put the almost 50-year-old pinball machines on public display later this year to be played by kids, big and small, for generations to come.
Gianfranco Di Giovanni reporting. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Melissa Clark.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. It can gather intelligence, pick targets, and plan bombings. Artificial intelligence is playing an integral part in the war in Iran. But while AI reshapes warfare, how can we be sure it's not making mistakes? Today, Toby Walsh, the chief scientist at the AI Institute at the Uni of New South Wales, on what's unfolding on the battlefield. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.